Do you recognise this voice?
Previously on MasterChef Australia. From Melbourne's mean streets.
You could say this was the murder we missed.
A story you'll have to hear to believe.
He said he was a 200-year-old vampire.
Why was Shane Chantra's abbot gunned down before giving evidence? AC/DC are back. Forget what happened last year. Last week. It's what happens next that matters.
And what does happen next? You get to meet the man behind that gutsy voice, perhaps one of the most recognisable voices in TV and radio, even if you might not recognise the man himself. He's voiceover artist Ian Lofty Fulton. But what that snippet doesn't reveal is that Lofty was born with achondroplasia, often known as dwarfism. He's written about his challenges and triumphs in a new memoir. It's called Lofty, My Life in Short. And he joins me now. Welcome, Lofty.
Thank you very much, Hilary. Thanks for having me on.
You certainly have an amazing voice. It sounds like it's kind of being dragged through gravel at times. Would I be right in saying it's scared some people away on occasion?
Yeah, actually, it came in handy to scare one particular person away. And this is going back a number of years. I think it was about the mid-90s. And I was married at the time. And my ex-wife was away at work as a midwife on an evening shift. And the kids doing the teenage thing out and about, living their lives, and I'd gone to bed. Then all of a sudden, out the back, the dogs start barking. I thought, well, that's nothing new. Somebody just walking past the back fence. They always let us know when that's happening. And Dreyfus, the more vigilant of the two, decided, no, Dad, I haven't finished yet, and ran to the back of the pergola and started barking out into the darkness. And I thought, oh, okay, it's a cat or a possum or something like that sitting there. And so I went out to inquire as to what was getting his attention, and thankfully didn't turn the light on. There was this shadowy figure sitting on our back fence. I just went, oh, God. Please, can I sound really scary? I just went, whoever you are, just go.
And he went, oh no, there's a true crime podcast in the house. I can't go in.
Yeah, they actually left. And didn't hesitate. They disappeared pretty quickly. I was shaking like a leaf, shall we say. But thankfully it came in handy.
And we'll hear a little more later about the role that your voice has played in your life. But let's go back to way before your voice broke. What news did the doctor have for you when you were five?
Hilary, the most devastating news I'd ever heard in my life, which is why I think I remember it so clearly. And I was asked this same question just recently, and somebody said, well, I can't ever remember going to the doctor at five, but it was such a big day in my life that the doctor had the task of telling me that I was never going to grow up to be tall because I was born into a family where I was the only one with dwarfism, the fourth of four children, and so there was no history of it anywhere in the family tree. So when I came along, it was a bit of a surprise, and somebody had to break the news to me that shattered my world that day. And thankfully it was the doctor, because I certainly wouldn't have been too happy if it was mum or dad.
And you got quite a lot of varied reactions from different people in the family. Tell us how they responded.
Most were incredibly supportive, with the exception of my grandmother. And, God rest her soul, I suppose, shall we say. She said to my mother, now, Valerie being my mother's name, I think it best if you keep Ian home and keep him hidden away from the world. And of course she came from a time when that kind of thing was done, but thankfully my mother didn't want a bar of it. And then of course when it came to school, she again tried her best and said, now Val, I think it would be best for everyone if you kept him home. Now by best for everyone, of course, I think she meant that she wouldn't be embarrassed by having a dwarf who was a grandson or a grandson who was a dwarf. But, I'd like to say it was for my benefit, but it was all for hers.
And this is, in 1964 in Burnie in Tasmania. It's, I imagine, a place where you wouldn't run across many other people with achondroplasia. That must have been pretty hard going through school, in those circumstances.
It was. Burnie was where I scored my first full-time radio job. I actually grew up in Launceston. And Mum had seen, when I was born, another man around town who had dwarfism. She'd never spoken with him, but she'd only ever seen him. So, of course, when I came along, she had lots and lots of questions to try and get answered, which weren't easy in those days. It was way before Google. People went to the library and dragged out encyclopedia and and textbooks to get the information they needed. But being such an oddity as dwarfism is only encountered about one in every 25,000 to 50,000 people born, depending on which particular source you look at. But around 25,000, one in 25,000 is the number. So in a town like Launceston, where the population at the time would have only been around the 50 to 60-odd thousand, yeah, I was very much an oddity.
And you write very movingly in the book about the bullying that dogged you all through your school years, but in high school, it sounds like it hit a real peak. Tell us how extreme that bullying got then.
It got really extreme. Thankfully, I must confess, absolutely none of it was violent. But I think also back then you had punishment by the cane or the cuts or the strap, whichever school you went to. So if you got violent in the schoolyard, chances are you were going to get the cane. So kids, you know, wanted to protect themselves from doing that. But it was all verbal. It was the first week or so of year seven of high school. And this one particular kid decided that he was going to call me Pumpkinhead. And that went round the school like wildfire. And for 3.5 years, at every particular opportunity, I could be walking, you know, to the canteen. I could just be minding my own business and I'd hear, "Hey, Pumpkinhead!" And then a raft of laughter. There was also cruel caricatures left in my locker. And people might go, "Well, you know, it's just a name. What's wrong with that?" It's the thing about the intent with which those names are said. And it was meant to be cruel. It was cruel. I found it very hurtful. It scarred me a lot. And then about halfway through year 10, probably the toughest kid in the school, and we'll call him Stan for the sake of the story, came up to me one day because his sister had moved into a unit across the road from where I'd lived. And on the day they moved in, I just simply wandered over and said, "Would you like a hand to unload the trailer?" So Stan and I got to know each other that day. And I thought, well, he's, you know, the toughest kid in the school. He's not going to talk to me on Monday. But on Monday, he came up to me and he said, "Hey, Ian, so-and-so teases you, doesn't he?" I said, "Yep." I said, "You can set your watch by it every single day." And he said, "I don't like him. Tell me next time he does it and I'm going to have him." And so, of course, the next day, "Hey, Pumpkinhead." "Hey, Stan." "Hey, Ian. What's up?" "Well, it happened again. Don't worry, I'll take care of it." I didn't see this happen, Hillary, but I know it had. And I'll recount the story the way Stan basically told me. The bullies, you know, being 3 or 4 abreast and being the cool kids swaggering down the middle of the corridor. And Stan came by himself the other way, grabbed the main offender by the scruff of the neck and slammed him up against the locker and said, "You've been teasing my friend Ian Fulton, haven't you?" And, well, he basically turned to jelly and started stammering, going, no, I haven't. So I swear I haven't." And he was looking for his cohorts to give him a hand, but none of them were going to take Stan on. And Stan just set him straight and said, "You have, I know it. Next time you do it, I'm going to have you." And from then on, it was pure radio silence. I never heard the name Pumpkinhead again, neither from Bob the Bully or any of his other cohorts or anyone else, because they all knew that they were going to get clobbered if they did.
It's and good to have allies.
Oh, I am so eternally grateful to Stan if he's hearing his story today, and I hope he appreciates just how much he saved my sanity.
You're on Life Matters on RN. My guest is Lofty Fulton. He's written a memoir called Lofty, My Life in Short. Now, Lofty, that bullying had a real impact on you in so many different ways, but you discovered when you were 15 that there was going to be something really on your side. Tell us what happened then.
Around the age of 15, most boys experience the whole teenage pubescent angst of their voice breaking, and often it's that choir boy falsetto to baritone and everything in between, and, you know, the voice going from here to there and back up again before it finds a place to settle. And one morning I woke up, it was a Saturday morning, and spied my mother down the hallway, and being, as I say, the fourth of four children, I issued a request she had heard hundreds of times throughout that time of her life raising kids, and I just said, "Cup of tea and toast, thanks, Mum." And she stopped dead in her tracks, wheeled around and stared at me as if to say, "Who are you and what have you done with my son?" And Mum, being who she is, a great stickler for manners, I thought to myself, perhaps I forgot to say, "No, I know, I said thanks, Mum, I don't know what the problem is." She said, "What did you say?" "See, cup of tea and toast, thanks, Mum." And I thought, gee, perhaps I'm getting a cold. But no, my voice had broken overnight, and that was it. And that's where it settled, and that's where it stayed.
And it took you to some incredible places, one of which was my old stomping ground, Shepparton, in Victoria's Goulburn Valley.
3SR.
So
yes.
Much yacht rock. Unbelievable. Yep. So you, over the years, built this amazing career in voiceover work, radio and TV. But behind the scenes, Lofty, your mental health was increasingly troubled. Tell us about that journey.
I didn't realise it, Hillary, and I use the analogy of rose-coloured glasses, that if you've always worn them, you've always had them on, you don't know any different. And what I learnt from my breakdown was that I had always been a very, very anxious person right from a young child. And when you consider that, I was born into a family where my grandmother wanted me to be locked away and then I got bullied at school, it's no great surprise to anyone, I think, that I had a few hang-ups. And I'd stuffed all the emotions down and tried to keep them, you know, where they should be. But like a powder keg, one day a spark got lit. It exploded and I fell off an emotional cliff and fell into a pit of darkness like I'd never known before. I thought I had been depressed and, you know, people would even say to me, how are you feeling today? Oh, I'm a bit depressed. No, I'd been blue before and, you know, had a bad day like we all do. But this was like nothing I had ever known. And I fell into a bout of clinical depression and general anxiety disorder. And for 3 months, it ruled my life. And during that time, my partner, Helen, who I love dearly and who I know loves me dearly, she was happy if I was able to get out of bed, have a shower, and even if I went back to bed, that was it. Because people think, you know, depression is one of these things of, get over it, which I liken to saying to somebody laying in a hospital ward with a broken leg and their leg in traction. It's like saying to them, you know, get up, go for a run around the block, you'll be fine. Mental illness, just like physical ailments, it takes time to heal. And it was like nothing I'd ever experienced before. And somebody had said to me once, and to use their analogy for it, it is like swimming in mud. You're making an incredible amount of effort to get nowhere.
And you write very very movingly about the years of therapy and the key moments that helped you get to the work in progress that you call Lofty 2.0. And it's great to hear.
Complete with new software.
Yeah.
Yeah, back the fatter on track. Belly than what I used to have, yeah.
And I'm wondering, I mean, you've hit the peaks of your work life with MasterChef. I'm wondering what's the ultimate goal beyond that? I mean, Eurovision, what's left?
Eurovision, if you heard me sing in the shower, then no. You mean as the announcer for Eurovision?
Oh, you know, whichever.
Either way, I don't know that I'll quite make it on either front of those, but I've always aspired to do movie trailers, the ones that we hear on television for the big Hollywood blockbusters. I've done the Australian release of those Hollywood blockbusters, but I would really like to do that kind of work for the States one day with the American accent and, you know, in a world, all
in
of that
a
kind
world.
Of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the holy grail for me career-wise. Whether I ever get to achieve that, I don't know, but I'm certainly going to give it my best shot.
Well, I hope you can keep chipping away at that US market and make some inroads like you have done in so many areas of your life. Thanks so much for telling us some of your story today, Lofty.
Hillary, thank you so very much for having me on the program. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. That's Ian Lofty Fulton. His memoir is called Lofty, My Life in Short. And if that discussion of anxiety and depression or bullying has brought up any issues for you, remember there's always someone you can talk things through with on Lifeline 13 11 14. I'm Hillary Harper. You're on Life Matters on RN.